So welcome everybody. We are going to do a short panel talk about the move that we are going to do about towards dry artificial grass for our game of hockey. We all know that there are already different forms, obviously, of dry artificial grass, which today we call sand filled or sand dressed, and there are other forms. But yeah, this is going to be a dry artificial grass form that should replicate the playing abilities of our current water-based pitches. So that will be quite something new. So we've got some special people on the call today here. We're going to open with Alistair Cox, who is working for the FIH and is their specialist in this matter, everything that's related to facilities and especially artificial grass, obviously. That all comes down to Alistair. So Alistair, very happy to have you on the call, and we will start with you in a minute. The next one will be Colin Young. Colin Young is R&D director for Tangata Grass, a company that is producing these kinds of fields. We also have Stephen Butler from a well-known hockey brand called Osaka. And Stephen is in the call as in his capacity as a shoe brand, because obviously shoes will also be very much impacted in this move to a new surface. But yeah, the guys obviously impacted the most will be the teams playing on the surface. So we have Adam Commons, high performance director for Belgium, from a coaching perspective, and we have Jeroen Hertzberger, who needs no introduction as a international player, and yeah, still active player. With a lot of experience on different kinds of surfaces. So we are also yeah, very keen on your perspective on this move. But let's start with Alistair Cox. Alistair, tell us a little bit about yeah, why do we make this move to dry artificial grass?
Thanks for inviting me to join you today. As you've already mentioned, hockey's been played on synthetic turf since 1976, the Montreal Olympics, and it was found at a very early stage that the performance on the surfaces was far superior on a wet surface, particularly in those early days when everybody was playing on a nylon carpet. When it was dry, it was quite sticky, high grip, not very satisfactory at all. So the sport recognized early on watering the fields was advantageous, improved the playing qualities, allowed the players to excel and to show their skills and for the game to develop into what we see today around the world. And in the early 90s, the FIH wrote its first standards defining the qualities required from the surfaces and the fields that are used at the different levels of the game, and particularly at the elite level. And those standards are now used across the world to ensure that fields are consistent and provide satisfactory venues for high-level hockey. And from the early 90s, the FIH standards have said you had to play on a wet surface. You had to have an irrigation system. The fields had to be watered. However, it's become increasingly clear that the use of water is becoming more challenging in many parts of the world. Water is becoming a valuable and scarce commodity. Some data that we looked at showed that by 2040, most of the major hockey playing nations in Europe and around the world will either have a medium to high risk or a high risk of being what they call in a water scarcity situation. That is basically where demand exceeds capacity. So there are potentially going to be water shortages. That's obviously going to have an impact on the sport. If we can't provide water to sustain life, it's not good to be pouring thousands of liters of water onto a plastic turf to enable people to play a sport. The cost of the irrigation systems is also a major barrier to people building venues and fields for the high levels of the game. An irrigation system is probably the best part of 100,000 euros. That's a big expenditure for a club, a community, or anybody wishing to invest, and particularly in the developing parts of the hockey community where they have aspirations to host higher level tournaments, suddenly facing large costs to build these fields. And then there's the ongoing cost of the water. In many parts of the world, water is expensive. You have to pay for the supply, you have to pay for the disposal. So again, that makes it difficult for people to invest in the top surfaces. And then I think finally, we're all becoming very aware of the need to protect the environment, to become carbon neutral. Looking at CO2 emissions, 1 cubic meter of water produces three, or the production of 1 cubic meter of water produces about 3 kilos of CO2. Each time we water a field, we're putting on 5 or 6 cubic meters of water. So we are using water that is creating CO2, which is obviously contributing to the climate crisis that we see in many parts of the world. So looking at all those factors, our executive board in 2018 came to the conclusion that we needed to start to transition away from playing on wet fields. If the sport was to grow, to prosper, to develop, and to have a sustainable future, we needed to move in a slightly different direction. So at our Congress in 2018, it was announced that we basically threw out a challenge to the synthetic turf industry. Can you develop surfaces that allow hockey to be played in the way it is currently played without the use of significant quantities of water or no water at all? At that point in time, we had set the Paris Olympics in 2024 as a target. We had an aspiration that Paris would be played on a dry surface. As I mentioned, that was late 2018, and about 18 months later, the world ground to a halt with the pandemic, and everybody struggled. We couldn't do the R&D. The manufacturers couldn't do the work they needed to do. We couldn't do the research we needed to do. So effectively, we've lost 18 months, 2 years in that program. And Paris will be played on a field that requires water, but it will use significantly less water. So that's a big step forward, but it's not the dry surface we're looking for. So looking ahead, we've now set the target of the World Cups in 2026, which obviously will be now in Belgium and the Netherlands. And probably the bigger target was the LA Olympics in 2028. We all know California has a big water shortage issue. So it would have been a challenge to go into California and ask for four fields or three fields that were requiring vast quantities of water three or four times a day for the duration of the hockey tournament. What we have done in that intervening period is, as I mentioned earlier, we have standards that define the qualities required from the turf. Now, those standards up until now, because we said it had to be wet, we didn't need to measure things that the water influences. If it's wet, it's okay. We all know that. But if we are removing the water from the system, we need to verify that the performance of the surfaces is satisfactory and what the sport desires as far as possible. So we commissioned research in 2020, which was undertaken by one of the accredited test institutes, a company called Labosport. It's based in the UK. And they worked in conjunction with Loughborough University, again in the UK, who have a lot of experience in doing player feedback assessments, etc., etc. So they started off by setting up some focus groups to talk to players to say, what is it you like about wet surfaces? What is it you dislike about dry surfaces? To get an understanding of what we're talking about. We obviously had an idea, but we wanted that verified independently, and we wanted to get feedback from current players. So the focus groups produced a group of answers. We then put a questionnaire together, and we shared that with all of the Olympic squads who went to Tokyo in 2021. So I think a small benefit of the lockdown and the pandemic was with the players locked in their bedrooms in Tokyo, they had time to complete our questionnaires. So we got over 230 responses from players, both genders, all positions on the field. It was statistically a really good representation. That has allowed us to verify these are the things that water make a positive contribution to. These are the things that the players disliked about playing on a dry surface. Having identified those properties, we then challenged the company Labosport to go away and to develop ways to measure them and to then start to gain data to define this is how wet surfaces perform. These are the properties. These are what you get when you do the same test on a current dry surface. So we now have a way of measuring the properties that the water influences. And ideally, we will be able to set criteria that basically says on a wet field, you get this level of performance. If you make the same measurements on a dry field, on a field without water, we're actually using the term non-irrigated, because I think it's very important to say at the outset, we don't want to end up like cricket or tennis. At the first time we get a shower of rain, everybody has to come off the field and go and sit in the grandstands. We will play on wet fields. What we don't want to do is artificially water the fields. So non-irrigated is now the term we are using, but everyone's
duly
commonly
noted.
Referring to dry field.
Duly noted.
Yeah. So ideally, if Colin and his peers and all the other companies, and we are aware that there's two or three companies as well as Tenkata looking to innovate and develop new surfaces, if they do their job admirably, they will have surfaces that have properties that are very, very similar to the existing wet surfaces. Happy days, we can move forward easily and simply. If they can't achieve everything, then we will have to have a discussion to what degree can we compromise on certain aspects to achieve the objective of playing on non-irrigated surfaces at the elite level moving forward without making a significant change to the way the game is played. You know, the sport has evolved to what it is today. We have no intention of moving it backwards to where it was 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Cool.
So that's really where we are today.
Absolutely. Colin, can you explain a little bit more where Tenkata Grass is going with these directives?
Yeah, of course. And thank you very much for the invitation to participate. I feel like a bit of an imposter with all of these expert hockey people on the call and myself not so much. But yeah, I appreciate your time and hopefully we can contribute some interesting insight from our side. So from a Tenkata point of view, we might not be completely visible on the market. So just to give people a bit of an idea of who we are, we're probably the world's largest synthetic turf manufacturer. Our historical business, which is over 300 years old and 50 years in turf, has been on the making of components. So we've historically made the fibers, the synthetic turf blades, that go into the product and other components, and we've sold those into the marketplace, and other people have assembled those products into turf, and that's been going on for many, many years. Around 15 years ago, we acquired a few companies that actually made the turf, and our main brands are Greenfields and Tiger Turf, who are again working with Alistair at the FIH as preferred turf producers, along with many other companies. Myself, like I say, I'm not really a hockey person, but I was just telling the gentleman on the call around 25 years ago, I was commissioned to do it. Well, I was researching and I was successful enough in applying for a PhD around these new kind of surfaces that were coming online in England that required different types of water, and the sort of transition from nylon to polyethylene, and water was becoming the predominant surface. And yeah, this was 23, 24 years ago. And what was amazing at the time to me, not being a hockey person, was the speed and the skill that was derived from those surfaces versus the sand-based fields at the time. And the amazing amount of different attributes that the players required, and how good players could really demonstrate their skills above average players on these kind of products. And time again on the feedback from players and doing the research and the measurements, that's what came across. So as Alistair mentioned, as we become more aware of the sustainability issues and the stress on water around the world, even in our relatively wet climates in Northern Europe, we appreciate that we need to do something about that. But at the same time, we really don't want to change the game, and we want to make sure that the players and the coaches are still having a good time playing. And also it's great for the spectators, because ultimately that's critical to the game, certainly the high level. So a lot of the research that we've done, and of course Alistair mentioned the timeframes on this, is been around trying to mimic and emulate what good quality water-based fields deliver, but without the need for irrigation. The critical challenges that we see, and we whilst there are many, we sort of categorize them into two or three key areas. The first one being ball speed, and how the ball interacts with the surface and what water allows that to do, which is completely different to a dry field and a sand field, of course. And the research, Alistair touched on it, that the FIH have done and commissioned is really, really interesting. And we've certainly leaned on that a lot in our product development to get inside. So we want to keep that ball fast. We want to keep it smooth, consistent, and allow those 3D skills that the players can utilize in the game. Whilst at the same time not making the surface too slippery and second interaction of the player, both biomechanically when they're running and turning, but also when they're potentially going to dive or even fall on the surface, which is obviously a big part of the game these days. And it still amazes me how quick and how much players are able to launch themselves in front of the ball, traveling at stupid speeds, and it still amazes me 25 years since I started doing this research. So we're very aware of what we're doing and what we're developing, that we don't want to change that approach, those skills, that ability. So we've worked really, really hard on that. We've had many failures as part of the research process, and our research process, it starts in the laboratory. We're lucky that we've got a very big lab. We can get a nice big section, 8 meters wide by around 30 meters long. We can roll production width rolls of turf out, dry and wet and sand, and we can get players in there to validate and test what they feel, what they like. And that's very much been our approach. Most of us in my company are engineers or chemists, extrusion. We know about that side of things, but we don't know as much about the players and what they need and the coaches. So we're bringing them into our laboratory on a regular basis. Here's a new idea. What do you think? And we again lean on their experience and feedback to allow us to iterate and develop the next generations. So that's really what's driven the process. Of course, COVID was a bit of a challenge from a player access point of view, but actually from a sitting down thinking from first principles, it was quite a useful time for us because we got to take a bit more of a deep dive and a broader review of things whilst we couldn't travel and meet people. So that was actually quite useful from that side of on R&D. But yeah, it still posed quite a few challenges, and I wouldn't want to go through that again. I'm sure we'd all agree. So we've come up with a product. We're currently branding that as Pure EP. We installed the first small sided pilot just over a year ago in the Netherlands at a club called Huissen. Apologies for the people at that club for my mispronunciation in English. And we've been doing a lot of feedback and testing with players there. We've changed that once so far. We're going to change it a third time shortly as part of the feedback to try and get it better. Based on the latest trends there, we are, excuse me, we're going to install a full-size field just outside of Amsterdam, hopefully in the next month. And we welcome anyone that's interested to come and have a look at that. Our plan really is, because it's still a transformational system, because we're still trying to bridge that gap between current wet and dry, is we don't want to install this on international high-end elite venues. What we're working with clubs and our clients at the moment is replacing sand-filled or sand-dressed products with this. So we're not currently saying that we want to be replacing our high-end water-based fields today, but we'll bring it in through maybe the team two, team three, depending on the size of the club, through to those players. And of course, at the same time, allow access to that as part of the R&D process. So the first one will go in with April. And again, we're very happy to invite anyone that would like to have a play on that and give us as critical feedback as possible. We prefer negative feedback to positive feedback from a product development point of view. But of course, if it's positive, well, we'll take it. And then we'll probably install another between 5 and 10 full-size fields in 2023. That's our plan. And again, this will be validated through the FIH national standard, which is not a global wet standard for the time being. But it won't require sand or water. And that's partly to get that feedback to do the iterations that we need to do. And we can hopefully start to get some experience about how that's impacting the players and the game as we're going through. If I talk about where I think we are in terms of if I try and prejudge and guess what that feedback's going to be, in terms of ball speed, 3D skills, consistency, we think we're getting pretty close. But again, we want to validate that on the full size field. In terms of grip and comfort, again, we think we're getting pretty close. One of the areas where we still are struggling is going to be one of skin abrasion. So when players are diving on the field, and the potential for abrasion burns or friction burns, that is something that we're struggling to emulate without water. Now, we think we're significantly better than sand, and we're better than current fields when they're dry, but we're not at the level of wet fields today. And that's something that is going to be a very hard adaptation for us to deliver with the materials that we're currently doing. There's still room for improvement, but that's one of the areas that is still for us a red flag. But the speed of the game, the skills, the 3D skills, the comfort, and the ball speed, we think we're getting quite close. But again, we'll let the more qualified hockey players come on there and tell us exactly when they get the opportunity to do that. So
Okay.
that's all for now. I'll hand over to them. Thank you very much.
Yep, cool. Stephen, maybe let's talk from a shoe perspective. So what is needed for you guys to follow in this trend and make sure that the shoe fits the turf?
Yeah, I mean, look, well, first of all, thanks for having us on, of course. I think to Alistair and to the FIH, I think it's we absolutely understand the need for change. And I think that's good to protect the future of the sport and for the sustainability as he discussed. And when Alistair explains it, you see, okay, yeah, there is a problem there. So I think that's a good thing. From a brand point of view, we're here to serve our athletes. That's what we're here to do. So like a player like Jeroen, actually we'll be driven by the feedback from the athletes. The challenge, I guess, from a brand point of view is that it takes time, huh? It takes time with prototyping and testing. And all this is very new and it's coming quite quick. So that's where the difficulty will be. I'm very happy to hear that from Colin that we get an invite to test on one of the fields. That's something we'll do. But I think where the issues will be from the footwear development will be that you'll need a shoe that does two things that can react to different conditions, because potentially it will be a dry field, potentially if it rains it will be a wet field. I would imagine that the piles, I don't know much about the actual surface yet. I imagine that the pile would be quite thin if it's based upon a carpet, so it's probably going to go with maybe a herringbone style cleat, very small cleats or something like that. Because we'll have to be careful and see for the feedback from the players as well with the grip point of view. So we've developed shoes for like a paddle, indoor paddle surface. That's a very thin pile, also very hard. But when you play, we did testing with hockey shoes on that, and there's just far too much grip in that situation. So that's something we're really going to have to put a lot of testing into, and time is not on our side. So we're going to have to move pretty fast. And then the last challenge I see, of course, is when I hear the quantity of pitches going down. It's going to take time. So you're talking about 5 or 10 pitches maybe by 2 or 3 years. From a brand point of view, and to make it scalable, we need the mass obviously to come. Because so it looks like we'll have to have a few options of hybrid shoes to start out.
Yeah, because I think that the biggest challenge will be exactly that is dealing with both a dry surface and a wet surface. And how do you are there already solutions for that, either Alistair or Colin?
I'll speak first. Yeah, from from our side, so when we've been doing player testing, of course, and Alistair touched on this as well, it's a non-irrigated field, so it needs to perform in all the conditions that hockey is played in, whether it's wet or dry, hot or cold. So that's one of the things, which is why we did the outdoor pilot over a year ago. And from a footwear point of view specifically, we tried to make it, and this is a great thing about surface research. If you're developing most sports technology equipment, you're doing it for the individual. Whereas when we're developing a surface, we're doing it for the number of players, thousands of players that are using that particular facility. So that makes it quite a challenge to design to the what the keeper wants and what the striker or the defender, whatever the position is required. So you're appreciating I don't know about hockey with my terminology there as well, apologies. But what we did was we made sure that the players were wearing their current footwear that they're used to doing, because we wanted to try and make that transition as minimal as possible. But just to Stephen's point, there still will be some iterations that will be needed. We don't want it to be too much grip, because obviously that's dangerous, but also we don't want the grip to be too low when it's wet, because otherwise players are going to be falling over all the time. So there's going to be some development, and again, Stephen, we can talk about this, and we can send you samples and invite you to the site to support that as well. Very happy to do that. But hopefully the feedback so far is the majority footwear has been designed to be thought of and included within the system. But inevitably, when players get onto a full size field and get a bit more dynamic, we might identify some changes there that are needed. And any advice on footwear or other equipment will be very welcome.
Do you think that we are going to a situation where, again, we will need two pairs of shoes, Stephen?
I hope so.
Yeah, you do. I can imagine.
No, I think, look, I think probably not. We'll probably able to divide. We'll probably be able to divide the capabilities of the shoe. I think if we just need to indeed get some time on the field. I think there's enough technology now in our product development that we'll be able to find something that will be able to work under both conditions. It does happen in the game today. Yeah? It does happen. We all know that when there's a dry field, for example, today, it's a problem. Especially from a footwear point of view, you get far too much grip, and it becomes very dangerous for injuries. So that would be our biggest concern. But as I said, if when we get some time on the field, we can really do some quick testing to find out. I know that a player like Jeroen will know immediately when you give him a pair of shoes when we're trying it out, and we take up a couple of different prototypes that we'll get some fast results.
Adam, let's bring it to you. What are your concerns in in this evolution? And
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Anston. And I was really pleased to hear the different points that Alistair and Colin raised. I think that a lot of the way that it was articulated and the things that they have in mind are really on top of my list as well. I think there's probably two or three things that need to be discussed. And if I come just from a coach and as a hockey fan and someone that wants to see our sport succeed, and if we're to have a look at the four goals of FIH around developing innovative and exciting entertainment events, increase the degree of professionalism in sport, to build a recognised powerful image of hockey, and to generate millions more followers around the world. I think that some of the stuff that Alistair raised will really help us be able to drive that. But at the same time, we need to look at sports that attract those millions of viewers and maybe look at some of the things that they do as well to learn from sports that are maybe have a higher degree of professionalism than we do. I think one of the really big strengths around hockey is it is a sport that can be played on a variety of different surfaces. You know, we still have nations that play on grass or dirt pitches. You have you know, other types of artificial surfaces. You've got sand we've spoken about. We have this new non-irrigated surface, and of course you have the water pitches. And I think that, you know, as a sport, we can play across all genders, all ages. That's really makes us unique. And that's always going to remain regardless of the type of pitch we play on at our major events. And that's what for us at the top level we're concerned with. What are the surfaces? What are they going to be that we play our World Cup and our Olympic Games and our Pro League on? And we have a look at sports that are fully professional. You know, I watched the Super Bowl last week. They have an $830 million system which rolls the normal grass out of the stadium to ensure it gets enough sunlight so their athletes can play on the best surface available. Not what produces the least carbon CO2, not what is the most sustainable, the best surface possible for the Super Bowl. You have basketball stadiums worth hundreds of millions. They don't say, let's play on cement because that's more accessible to everybody else. You've got football fields in the Premier League. The majority of them are watered before the game, watered at halftime. And that's not even to mention how much water they use during the spring or summer to water the grass. Now, and here we are as a sport that's aspiring to be professional, to make our sport really attractive. And we're concerning ourselves with things that other professional sports maybe have less concern with. And that's not to diminish any of the messages that Alistair had, because I think that it's really relevant and something that certainly if we're going to be sustainable, we have to go down this path. So I'm in full agreement there, but I'm talking about World Cups and Olympic Games. Are we ready to jump straight to that that step of a non-irrigated pitch without risking the spectacle? And Colin mentioned that that's certainly not the aim. The second point for me would be around athlete well-being, and Stephen mentioned it, and I think this is the major one. I just wanted to put out my perspective as a hockey fan and around this spectacle of the sport. But the athlete well-being, I think, you know, if we talk now, and I spoke with many international coaches before I came on here. I spoke with Max Caldas, Shane McLeod, Michelle van der Hervel, Jemelon Mulders. I spoke with Jamie Dwyer. I spoke with Mick McCann. I spoke with Mo Firstar about this. And there was not one player that or coach that said that, you know, in the current situation that they feel that a dry pitch would make our sport better and would not risk our athletes without seeing what was there. And so I really enjoyed what Colin was saying before. But the main thing is around, will the athlete surface interaction be good enough that we're not going to have knee injuries, we're not going to have ankle injuries, we're not going to have, you know, skin infections, all of this type of stuff at our major tournaments or in the lead up to our major tournaments while we're developing these surfaces. And coming from Belgium, where we are the host of the World Cup in 2026, I know that we're already in discussions about not even installing an irrigation system in the stadium, and the pitch, the first iteration of the pitch going in 2024. Now, as a performance director, I'd have real hesitations in putting our national teams on an experimental dry surface, train and play, the lead up to a World Cup, knowing that there could be a risk of injury. You know, I'd want to have some pretty good testing in the lead up to that. And that's probably the main concern of all of those coaches that I spoke to and players that I spoke to around the risk of injury and the player interaction, not only with a dry, sticky pitch, but if it isn't sticky, then when it's wet, is it too slippery? And how do we handle that situation? So that'd be my only concerns there, whilst acknowledging the story of making our sport sustainable. I think that's we have to, it's unavoidable, but how quick we do it, that's going to be the challenge.
Yeah. Okay, guys. Before circling back to Colin and Alistair about this, let's also hear from Jeroen Hertzberger. Jeroen, as a player who's still an active player at the highest level, you've already been through different types of fields with different conditions and more slippery dry pitches, wet pitches. what is needed from a player's perspective to make this a smooth transition?
Well, it's always nice to go last. First of all, thanks for having me, and it's great to hear from you all about how you how your opinions are on this matter, because obviously it's very complex, and it's actually quite interesting for me, because I'm even though I'm the youngest in this call, I consider myself a very old player. So, but it's good because I can see. Look, I grew up in countries where hockey wasn't very big. I grew up in Budapest in Hungary and in Vienna, Austria, where I played on grass till I was 16, and I can still remember offside. I played sand pretty much 90% of the time. So I'm very aware of the importance of getting pitches to be accessible all around the world. However, I wrote a few things down that jumped in my mind. And the first thing that comes to mind is, so you have speed and you have safety. So obviously safety is the big thing here, which is the main conclusion. I mean, we can talk for hours, but at the end of the day, like Adam said, the well-being of the players is obviously the most important, because we can't have people get injured on the pitch, on live TV, because it's just, well, that's not good for the sport. And then the speed is something that I think I don't worry about the most, because when we had the transition, I mean, I've played on wonderful natural grass fields where I really felt like I was playing at Wimbledon, which was very quick, and I've played on terrible water pitches. So the speed thing is something that I don't worry about too much, because we had the transition from grass to sand-based. Then there was the nylon era where it was so quick and it was actually drier than pitches are now. So if I look at as a player, if my socks are usually wet after a game because the layer of water is quite high on the pitch, and in the nylon pitches or the AstroTurf, I'm not sure what the right name is, the ball would be flat. You'd be like playing on a snooker table, and it felt like it was wet. And even if it got a bit dry, it was still okay to play on. And now pitches are wetter, so especially the Polytan fields, the one we use in World Cups and in Olympics. The blue pitches, so they're very wet, and there's a lot of water which they need, and they're a bit softer. So the speed has been going up and down in the last 20 years. So that's something I don't worry too much about. However, the safety, yeah, that's the big one here, because there are even players now that are covering their knees with tights, because even with the water-based pitches, sometimes skin injuries is a thing. And what we actually want to see in our game is we want to see diving tackles. We want to see players diving to the second post and getting on their stomach and getting on their knees, and because that's the sensation of the sport. However, what I wrote down is the performance side. Then there's also the planet side. So the planet side is interesting. I myself am interested also in the planet side, because I have a YouTube channel where I try to teach hockey all over the world, and I get messages from people all over the world, whether it's Nigeria or Kenya or Tibet, and people are playing on the most the surfaces you've never even seen, on gravel and things like that. And this sport needs to be how do you say, attractive to the planet, not only in a sustainable way, but also in accessibility, because it will help us grow the sport. So that's the other side of performance. So on the one hand, you have speed and safety, and on the other hand, you have planet and performance. And then there's another thing that jumped into my mind, is that fair play is also, if you look at performance, everyone needs to be able to prepare for a World Cup or an Olympics or a Pro League or whatever in the same way. And what we're now seeing is that there will be a big effect. Like Adam said, if these pitches are dry, they're going to be a lot different than when it rains. And the question is, how is that going to affect our game? And that's something which is difficult for me. I experienced it once in the World Cup 2014 in The Hague, where our whole preseason and our whole preparation was with a certain type of Kookaburra hockey ball. And then when the tournament started, we saw the ball that was lying there on the spot to start our first game, and we recognized there was a size difference between the balls. And apparently some of our competitors, of which also the Australian men, had been training with these balls for months, and we had not. And we simply did not know that the tournament was going to be played with a different size and a different type of water-based dimple ball. So there's a certain fair play. And that's what Steven said. It's going to take so much time to get these pitches laid all over the world that I don't even see it happening before 2026, because it simply wouldn't be fair for all the countries that need to prepare for these big tournaments, because they all need to have access to these pitches. And then there's always a climate thing, which is going to have a certain influence on how the pitch works. So long story short, I have no doubt that these pitches can be quick, however, and that we can play on them, but the safety aspect is going to be the biggest challenge. And so that's my point of view on the matter. So even though I don't really know much, I haven't seen the pitch in Vase, and I haven't stood on it, but like I said, I have no doubt that we're going to make sure that these pitches are going to be easy to play on, because we're an innovative sport. I mean, we've taken out offsides, we've taken off substituting, we have interchange, we have the self-pass. We've even tried to make field goals count double. We've had an own goal. So we're not scared to change. And some things are fantastic, like self-pass and shootouts and things like that are fantastic for our game. So yeah, time will tell if it's something that can actually be pushed through or not.
Absolutely. Alistair, some reactions from FIH maybe to these concerns.
Excuse me. I think many of the concerns that have been expressed are exactly where we started. And that's why we commissioned the player feedback, the player research, to get an understanding of these issues. In terms of dynamic response, the foot grip, etc., we have a lot of data on how the surfaces currently perform. We have experience of playing on dry fields, on wet fields. We have data from other sports that are using similar surfaces. The biggest challenge probably is going to be the skin abrasion. If you don't have water, there is going to be increased friction between the player and the surface. And we see this in other sports, rugby, soccer, etc., when they're playing on synthetic turf. And it may be that players will have to start wearing protective undergarments. The rules actually allow that already, that we allow Muslim women to wear undergarments to respect their cultural needs. So that is already in place. So if players wish to wear protective garments, that can happen. And I think some players will start off being cautious. That's fully understandable, and they will gain experience. And none of us really know how much of an issue that's going to be today. That will depend on the technology that Tenkata, Polytan and others can create, and people will become more familiar. And I think we're very aware that the first versions of these products that we're starting to see coming out into the market, Colin mentioned the prototypes that his company have. You may recall the FIH rang a Hockey Fives tournament in Lausanne last year on a temporary field. That was on a non-watered, dry, if you like, hockey surface. That was the first version of the product from Polytan. So we are starting to get experience. And during that Hockey Fives tournament, most of the time it was hot and sunny. It did rain one day, so that actually gave us a good contrast. People said it wasn't an issue adjusting between the two, which was positive. And equally, we didn't get significant complaints or concerns about the carpet burn. So that, again, was reassuring. But there are solutions out there, we believe, to address these issues.
Mm-hmm. Colin, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think, of course, player welfare, player safety is critical. And I think from Maroon, very right to raise that. Of course, there's the turf itself, which is obviously the critical bit. That's the thing that players are interacting with. But underneath the turf, we also have shock-absorbing layers, e-layers or shock pads, depending on what you want to call them. And what's certain is some of the changes we make for the fibres and the grass and the construction and the profile of that we also have to innovate what goes below it. So we're very confident from a stiffness, hardness point of view of running and falling, that we can mimic and be very close to the current fields, obviously leaning very heavily on the FIH criteria there. In terms of grip, too much, too little, and risk of injury, again, that's something that we're really, really focusing on. So I think Alistair's underplaying the amazing amount of research that's been done in this in the past and in the recent past as part of the transition. It's very detailed, it's very robust, and I think both ourselves as Tenkata and our competitors are also doing our own research. So I think none of us want to release a product that is unsafe. And of course, if we do go a bit too fast and a bit too far, then that will be remedied and replaced pretty quickly. And there'll be an iterative process. But anything that is released, it's really important that it meets those FIH criteria or the local other hockey federation criteria. So that's something that we're really keen on, making sure that we're not moving away from that in the chase for dry fields. And that's, again, a big focus point of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Adam,
yeah, I'd like to respond to. I'd like to respond because I think it's important to know where, as from a player point of view, usually when it comes to new pitches, and sometimes you arrive at a tournament, just speaking from experience, and you're not sure how new the pitch is, you're not sure if the field is going to be bouncy, you don't know if it's going to be this or that. And usually our conclusion is always the same, is that small play, because you gave the example of fives, in small areas, you're not going to notice the difference as much when it comes to how a field is played compared to the long distances. So usually you recognize the big difference between, let's say, a good and a bad pitch. When you're looking at the longer distance of play, so I talk about long passing, talking about long aerials, talking about long one-on-ones where you actually reach a high speed of above 25 kilometers per hour running and then hitting the brakes and then having to make an inside break, a 90 degrees turn. That's usually something that you don't get. You don't get these speeds and distances, and you don't get this momentum of bodies playing in small areas like, for example, fives. Just like in indoor hockey, you don't get these long distance speeds, you don't get the high sprint meters, and that's where I worry a little bit, because obviously in these testing, and if I'm not mistaken, the test field that's now placed in the Netherlands is a D court, so that's only a quarter pitch, if I'm correct, and that when you want to test a field, you can actually only test if you have a proper sized pitch and you can actually play 11 on 11 to see how things work out. So that's the main thing for me. I just wanted to add on, because usually it's not the stuff that happens in the D, and it probably won't be the penalty corner either, because these things, you know, you find a way to make it happen. But it's the long stuff, physically and technically, that will be influenced most by a change in surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Alistair, I see you nodding a lot.
Yeah, absolutely, and I fully agree with the comments that Jerome has made. That is why we're really keen, and you know, we're pleased to hear that Tenkata and others are planning to build full size fields this year with the first versions of these new products. We're going to introduce an innovation category of certification to give people the reassurance of the quality, the longevity. So, and I think, again, as Colin alluded to, we don't see these this year going into the top venues. This would be the second or third field, maybe, or at a community level. If you were considering a sand-dressed, a sand-based field, this is now an alternative. People want those to last for 10 years. They're still going to be expensive, so they need to have the reassurance. So we will bring in an innovation category this year to provide that reassurance to the market. We've also then commissioned Loughborough University, who I mentioned earlier, to develop a monitoring program for us so we can get elite players around the world to go onto these fields as they are installed, whether it's in the Netherlands or New Zealand, Australia, the UK, wherever. We need to get a very diverse feedback from players everywhere, different climates and temperatures, etc. Love for a world leaders in player feedback surveys. So we will collect that data, analyze it, and that will then give us more direction as to where the limits of acceptability that ultimately we need to set will be established, so that people can have the confidence when they turn up at a venue, it's going to have performance of a known quality.
But coming back also to a point that was raised by Jeroen earlier, because we have the time to make these changes and get used to it when it comes to the recreational level of our game. But in our high performance part of the game, and I'm going to ask Adam also about his opinion about that. Yeah, 2026 is around the corner. And the interesting remark made by Jeroen is, yeah, will there be a level playing field? Not just level playing field, but will there be a level playing field for all competitors at that World Cup to have the same possibilities of practicing and getting used to the new surface? Adam, what are your concerns about that?
I think that's a huge concern, because of course with Paris being played on a water-based pitch, then we will all teams competing there and trying to qualify will be training on an irrigated pitch in the lead up to that event. So we'll start, you know, trialing non-irrigated pitches late 2024, start of 2025. That's assuming you can get access to one, and some nations will have access and others obviously won't. And this is not something that, you know, you'll get right first pitch that goes down. And then, as you say, it is around the corner. You have then a World Cup being played on, I would say, still an experimental surface. And you know, I think we would need some sort of guarantees that if these surfaces are not ready, and by that I mean, you know, that there is a significant difference in the quality of play. I agree with Jeroen. I don't have too big a concern about ball speed, but I have a concern about how the players interact with the surface over a long distance. As he mentioned, that was an excellent point, and I was going to raise it as well. You only really see it over a long distance. And yeah, if we were having a rise in injuries, would we just simply push on and say, no, we've made the decision? Or would we have a discussion with the nations that are involved in these tournaments, whether it be qualification tournaments for a World Cup? So not only the competing nations, but, you know, I'd want some guarantees that our athletes and teams are going to be consulted in terms of do they feel that these surfaces are safe for athletes at the major events.
So Adam, I think the only thing that could actually make it work is if after, so post Paris, that there would be two seasons of Pro League played fully on these pitches. I think that's the only way you could actually get it to happen in 2026, is you need to have at least a year, favorably two, full Pro League seasons with these pitches. Another thing is that, like you said, if you get injuries and obviously also, Alistair, what you said about having to adjust to the pitches and taking measures, whether it's garments or whichever. And I think that's, what we're then doing is we're looking a little bit like the tennis world is based. So you have specialists on four different surfaces. I think it's, what is it, gravel, grass, and then hardcourt three, apologies. And then people are actually adjusting their playing style because of the pitch that they're on. Because in tennis, obviously, rolling your ankle is more likely on a hardcourt pitch because there's not enough possibility to slide, and gravel you have more opportunities to slide, and grass is a bit more forgiving but also has its pitfalls. However, before the chat started, or the panel, we spoke about 2003 on the Wagner Stadium. I think, Adam, you spoke about it. I advise you to go on YouTube and look at some games of that tournament in 2003, which was a fantastic tournament, by the way. But if you look at the speed of play and the dynamics and the mobility of players, it's so much slower than the past World Cup, and there's 20 years in between. And I think it would be very disappointing to see players having to calm down in their mobility and dynamics and speed because the possibility of injured. So the last thing what you would like is that to have players to be careful when they step on a pitch. What you want as an athlete is to think, okay, I'm playing on the highest podium, I'm playing at the World Cup Olympics, and everything has to be perfect, like Adam said about the NFL, about the NBA and all these fantastic venues in the US, where you just feel like I'm in the top of my game, in the top of my career. It's not something you want to be thinking about. So I think that's when it all comes back to player safety. If you want players to perform at the highest possible potential, the mind needs to be clear and empty. And all they need to be thinking about is how do I beat these guys? So yeah, that's.
Colin, do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah, I mean, look, everything we're trying to do is to mimic and emulate where we are today. And I know there's already a little bit of differences between surfaces that are water-based already on the market, but broadly speaking, they're providing a phenomenal surface and platform to play the game. So everything we're trying to do is to mimic that and close those gaps as much as possible. If we're going to be 100% there in 2023 or 2026, I don't know. But like Hurun said, we need full-size fields. We need to do this. I hope our way of transitioning sand fields rather than taking out water fields for these as phase one will allow that build-up of facilities in a relatively safe manner, and then they can be transitioned into the professional game when the feedback and when the time is appropriate. But of course, until you start playing on them, until we start getting these full-size field feedback, with all the due diligence, with all the great research for many people in the industry, we still are a little bit unknown. But we're extremely confident our side, from the small-scale research we've done, from the pilots, from laboratory work in the development, that we're getting really close. But until we've got that 6,500 square meter field, we can't be 100% sure, which is why the rollout phase this year and then the transition phase. So again, I just reiterate, anyone is welcome to get in contact with me to bring players and to experience once we've got these first few in. Anytime, please do that. We want all feedback, good or positive, or negative and bad. So yeah, I just encourage that as soon as we've got them in. That will really help with the speeding up and hopefully the closer emulation of where we are today with water fields.
Mm-hmm. Alistair, are these practice pitches, these trial pitches, being put in only in the Netherlands and maybe Belgium, or are they going to be put in different countries worldwide so that other countries qualifying or hoping to play the World Cup will also be able to test these?
That's absolutely our hope. In an ideal world, we would be able to fund this, but unfortunately, we don't have those resources. We're not football. We haven't got the resources they have available. So we will be encouraging national associations to put these into their national training centres, etc., as soon as possible to enable us to gain that information. And the feedback I'm getting from around the world as I visit people and attend conferences, etc., is there's a real appetite, almost a demand for these surfaces. In so many places, I was in Sydney last year, water is such an emotive issue in that part of Australia that hockey is really going to struggle if we don't have alternatives. It's almost to the point of saying you shouldn't be playing hockey. Why can you water the plastic turf when I can't water the golf course or the horse racing track or whatever it may be? And we need to offer alternatives to those communities. So I think there'll be a real appetite as soon as they see products out there that have some form of innovation endorsement from the FIH and others. They will go in, and that will allow players around the world to experience them for the first time.
Alistair, does that mean but that our major events should be played on those surfaces? Because we now have the opportunity to play on a variety of surfaces, but that doesn't mean that we need to play on an inferior surface for a World Cup or an Olympic Games, if I'm able to put it that way.
Absolutely. So at the moment, we have different categories of certification for the products, for the hockey turfs. The top category is our global category. And ultimately, in an ideal world, we will define the criteria for a global surface. And all we're going to do is remove the requirement that you have to water the field to provide that performance. So at the top level, if people want to provide a field that uses water, they can continue to do that. Tournament organisers, and that obviously includes the FIH in terms of the World Cups and the Olympics, can then make a decision. Do they use a wet field? Do they use a field that doesn't require irrigation? We've said that we will move towards non-irrigated surfaces because we think that's the future and we need to create that momentum. But I could set that criteria almost now. The challenge would be that if Colin and his peers from the other companies can't achieve it, then actually my standard is of no benefit to anybody. So we need to get the feedback to establish how close the products coming onto the market actually are to that ideal of replicating the wet field. If we find that they're very, very close, we publish a standard later in the year, early 2024, and then that would allow people to be using them in the Pro League and similar tournaments.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Adam, Jeroen already mentioned a little bit about the timings that he would feel are needed for a good performance on the highest level, being the Pro League seasons of 24-25 and 25-26 to be played fully on these pitches. What are your thoughts? What is needed for you in regards to timing? What's a cutoff moment for you?
It's hard to say, I wouldn't. You can hear me now? It's hard to say that, you would hope that you can have the 24-25 season to trial the pitches and to have feedback and to maybe have a second generation pitch by the time the World Cup was to come around. You'd hate to think that you have 6 months on the pitch in the lead up to the World Cup and you find it's far from ideal or it's not performing how you'd like it to, and eventually you have to play a World Cup on that style of pitch. So I think there needs to be some time, and as Jeroen suggested, 2 years I think is probably enough. I think less than that would be not ideal. And imagine you play at season 24-25 on the dry pitches, and the feedback from the athletes is, look, this is really problematic. This is causing issues with us. What is the decision then? And that's, where we're at now. I know we had the feedback from the players in Tokyo. I think I received that questionnaire. I spoke to Shane about it this morning. Interestingly, no one seems to remember it, but I remember getting questions. If we could have a dry pitch that was of the same quality as a wet pitch, would we use it? Well, yes, of course we would. And I think the way that the questions were structured were in such a way that you almost couldn't say no. And of course we had put other comments in, and we could give our comments about our gut feeling around it. But I think that having really transparent feedback after that particular season and having a cutoff date where, athletes put their support behind it, because I think ultimately that's what we need. We need our teams and our athletes to support this move. And you don't want to go to a major event where you have people that are negative about the surface that we're playing on. I thought Jeroen's point about going to a dream of yours, competing at a World Cup and an Olympic Games, and then being able to go out onto the pitch, have full confidence in it and play without thinking and having to play at a slower speed or having to adjust your playing style, you know, that would be a step backwards in terms of our of the spectacle of the sport, I'd say.
Stephen, your thoughts on this from the shoe perspective, what are cutoff times for you to make this work?
Yeah, it's obviously something I was writing down there. It's, I mean, our goal, of course, is to have the best products for the athletes. But we need about, yeah, the minimum time is about 18 months to develop a product because you have different phases. You're going to have your initial prototyping phase, and then you have to have time to get some feedback and test it. Then you go through a second prototyping, probably onto a third sample and a fourth. We usually do about four product runs. So you're probably talking about 24 months all in all. And then you have to develop the product itself. So yeah, it does take time. It does take time. But to be honest, it's very difficult to say until you get, like actually what Jeroen said was in my mind as well, with a full-on test on a full-on pitch, because until you get to that phase and then you get through your first two prototyping stages, yeah, then you can really start with opening molds and getting the product cycle running. The minimum is really 18 months, and it normally takes us 24 months for a new product, to be very honest.
Alistair, to come back to that as well, when will be the first moments that we can test these full pitches on a competitive level? Because, okay, when Colin mentioned that the pitches are going to lay up in the Netherlands and probably some other countries, these will be second or third pitches for clubs. So for the recreational level, to avoid the transition clash there, obviously. So, but when will we have a first pitch that is available for high performance testing?
I think we would like, and we will organise, as I mentioned, we've already commissioned Loughborough University to help us, but we would want to get high-performance athletes onto the second, third pitches that Colin is going to put into the Netherlands and Polytan are putting them elsewhere with their versions, et cetera, et cetera. We fully accept that people are not going to convert their main stadium field or the number one field to new technology. You know, that's that's reasonable. But we will need to arrange for players from the Dutch squad, the Belgian squad, the Australian squad, whoever it may be, to go to these venues to play on them. And we will need the assistance of the national associations, the high-performance coaches, you know, Adam and his colleagues around the world, to ensure that happens. Because clearly their expectation is going to be very different to a typical community player. And we need that high-level feedback.
Okay, guys, we've been talking for over an hour here and I want to take up your entire day, even if the topic is very interesting and it concerns all of us to a high degree. But let me give a last word maybe to Adam and then Jeroen again. We're going to do you last, but that's because I want you to have the last word in this talk. So, Adam, what were your final remarks or your final comments about this?
I thought it was a really productive chat and we got some great insights from both Alistair and Colin. I'm a bit of a hockey purist, if you like, and I want to see our athletes play on the best surface possible. So where they can go out there, have full confidence in the surface, produce a great spectacle. Our sport is super exciting. It's super fast. The skill level now is just amazing. And we have, you know, evolved these pitches to a level which allows us to present our sport in that particular way. So I'd hate to see a step backwards there. And finally, I just, you know, really hope that we are consulted in terms of the athlete interaction with the surface, what is their feedback, and if the feedback is that, look, this is in the right direction, but it's not there yet, that we just don't push forward and say we have to do it, that we say, okay, what are the things that we need to do to close the gap and to get it to a level that the athletes are comfortable and where they're happy to play a World Cup on. You know, I'd be, you know, that's a win-win for everyone and that's what we'd be after. But certainly some sort of moment where we say, okay, these are the athletes that we've spoken to. And this is their feedback. And we feel that we are close enough now with the measurements from Loughborough University. And then we can all push forward with a really positive message and one that everyone's fully behind.
Mm-hmm. Jeroen, you get the last say.
Oh, thank you. Well spoken, Adam. The reason why I have so much passion for this sport is because our sport is actually the ultimate combination between the physicality and then the technical skills or technique and then also tactics. And maybe ice hockey comes close, and there are a couple of sports where the combination applies as well. But for me, field hockey is the ultimate combination, which makes it, for me, the ultimate sport. And the surface plays just an unbelievable large role in what we're doing. Having said that, how our sport is being played on the entire planet is also important, just as our Olympic status, which is really important, which I think we didn't talk about today, but I'm sure also is something that plays a huge role. I mean, since I've played in the Dutch team from 2007 till 2021, and every 2 years there was always the threat of hockey maybe not being Olympic in the next Olympics. And I think that's also something we need to take into account. So on the one hand, the hockey player in me says, come on, LA 28, let's make it the most amazing hockey pitch we've ever played on. And on the other hand, I realize that we are in fact not a sport that has the resources that some other big sports do. So we need to be realistic as well. So I'm going to be very dramatic and leave it lovely in the middle right there. It's an interesting discussion, and time will tell how these prototypes are. And I obviously wish you guys the best of luck to with the development of that. And if you ever need someone to test the pitch in Australia, you can always call me. happy to go.
Happy to fly in. New Zealand is
happy to fly in. Yeah. I mean, I don't have time, but I can do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, guys, I want to thank all of you on the panel today for sharing your time and sharing your insights with us here. I think it's a very important discussion, not only for the planet perspective and the sustainability perspective. I think it's a very important aspect of our recreational part of the sport as well. But yeah, we'll be confronted with it at the high performance level first. So I thought it was very important to touch on those subjects as well. So, but thanks very much for sharing your thoughts on this. And I'm sure we'll follow it up. Thanks and bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you all.
Thanks. Bye. Bye-bye.